thank you for the introduction, and thanks for having me, you guys. I don't know about you, but I feel like the speakers ahead of me did a great job of making me want to go home and be better at what I do, and I think that's kind of the point of coming to these meetings is not everything might apply to what you do, but there's certain nuggets of every speaker that you can take home and make yourself better. And so I hope to give you a few nuggets of information that you can use as tools as well. And of course, you guys are all millennials like me, so you're online, you're tech savvy. You know what things are being said about you out there on the internet. And I think there's so much to think about as we begin our careers in production agriculture, and the one that's kind of easy to forget about is the person that you don't know, the guy that lives in the city, or the person that lives on the coast far away from your farm or ranch. But yet that person thinks they know you. They think they understand better than you how you should do your business. And guess what? They have a vote that can determine how you get to do your business in the future. And so one of the things that I do with Beef Magazine is I focus on consumer trends and kind of try to keep a pulse on what our consumer is saying and how we can correct some of the misconceptions that are out there. So I always like to tell the story. I'm in my 10th, going on 10 years of writing for Beef Magazine. And before I started at Beef, I had never really been on an airplane before. I'd never traveled. I started halfway through college. So my first year of college, I guess my background was my parents never really encouraged us kids to come back to the ranch. They always said, go find an easier life out there. Go, you're talented, you're smart, go where the money is easy, right? So even though my heart was in agriculture, that was always my mindset, that I was going to go to a big city somewhere and get a fancy job, and the money was just going to come rolling in. And so the first chance I had, I got an internship in Washington, D.C. for the summer. And I traveled to D.C. I was going to work for USDA on beef checkoff programs. And I get to Washington, D.C., and I check in at George Washington University. And I meet my roommate who'd been randomly assigned to me for the summer. Now, keep in mind, never been on a plane, never really been anywhere. You know, just a little farm girl from South Dakota. Introduce myself to my new roommate. Her name is Meredith, and she's an atheist vegetarian from New Jersey. So to say I was a bit of a culture shock was an understatement. I thought, whoa, how am I going to get along with this girl for the whole summer? And I'll never forget that first weekend we were in D.C. It was Memorial Day weekend. There was lots of parades and things going on, and we were exploring the city and practicing taking the metro so we knew how to get to our internships that Tuesday. And we were walking through a park, and there was a homeless woman sitting on a park bench. And a group of pigeons landed at the woman's feet. And all of a sudden, the lady kicked at the birds. And Meredith stopped me, and she said, oh, my gosh, did you see that? And well, it's a little cold for homeless people in South Dakota. So I thought, well, no, I guess, you know, maybe we should buy her a burger or something. And she said, no, she kicked a bird. How dare she? And that's when I realized that, whoa, if I was going to make an impact with Meredith, or if I was going to be able to get along with her or have her understand where I come from and she understand, or me understand where she comes from, I might have to approach things a little bit differently. And it was over the course of that summer that I realized I don't want to go live in a big city somewhere. I'm pretty proud of my agricultural roots, and I'm going to work even harder to find my place back home in South Dakota and be a voice for my parents and grandparents and my friends and all the people that I know in agriculture. And so that's kind of how I ended up pursuing a career in ag communications and being a freelancer and writing for different publications. But I'll tell you what happened at the end of my speech with Meredith. So if I forget, remind me. But that's just in my studies of living with Meredith, that kind of gave me a template for how I think our consumers think. I think we all know that we have the science and research to back what we do in production agriculture. You know, we can justify anything we do, from dehorning to castrations to antibiotic use to the way we handle our cattle. But our consumer is wanting to hear the emotional side of it. They want to. We've all heard it. They want to hear our stories. They want to see the humanized version of today's food producers. And they want a story to go with their food. And yet the information they're getting, the information that my roommate Meredith had, were from things that she read on in the New York Times or from YouTube videos that she'd seen online. And in conversations with Meredith, she was certain that my family abused our cattle because she had seen a cow being drugged on YouTube. And she was certain that we were destroying the planet because of things that she had read about greenhouse gases being caused by production agriculture. And so I think there's a lot of emotions to it when our consumer goes to the grocery store, and I'll kind of break some of these emotions down for you quickly. The first is that lack of trust. Why does our consumer not trust that farmer? You know, if we go back a generation or two ago, everyone loved the American cowboy, the spirit of the West. All across the globe, you would have people that loved those Western movies and the ideals of that honest, hardworking, tough, and rugged American cowboy. But if you ask our urban consumers today what they maybe thought about cowboys, first of all, they probably don't think about us much at all. And second of all, what they know about us is what they're seeing in the news, and it's not very often very complimentary. Why? Well, unfortunately, in journalism today, with wanting to clickbait and get lots of viewers, everything has to be sensational, right? Everything has to be gossip or bad news. So you don't hear those positive news in the media today. But just a quick Google search on the EPA, for example. They've been a big thorn in our side for the last couple years and wanting to regulate farmers and ranchers out of business. Well, a quick Google search of the EPA shows just these top headlines. The EPA sues a 77-year-old farmer over Riverside Earthwork near Albany. The EPA sues a California farmer for plowing his own land. The EPA hits farmers with $16 million in fines for building a stock pond. Now, you and I, we know the story behind this. We know that these crippling burdens on these farmers and ranchers are likely to put them out of business, likely to end generations and lifetime of hard work just because of some regulation that they can't afford to pay. But what does our consumer think when they look at these headlines? They see the Environmental Protection Agency, and they trust that that organization is protecting our natural resources. And they see that the EPA is going after farmers. So 1 + 1 = 2, they can deduce that, hey, that farmer can't be trusted to manage his own land like he says he should be able to. And so I think the word sustainability has been stolen from us. It's that big buzzword. And in fact, I interviewed a real great environmental steward here a week ago for an article I was working on. And he told me he hated the word sustainability because to him it meant that we're just sustaining what we already have. But he said farmers and ranchers do better than that. They take the land and the resources that they have and they make them better, right? So I think we not only need to take that word sustainability back, but we need to take control of the conversation and talk about how we not only use those resources, but we enhance those resources that we have. And so I like to use graphics on social media like this one that was produced by the Beef Checkoff that talks about or compares 1970s beef production compared to today and how we use fewer resources. I think visuals like that shared on Facebook or Twitter or Pinterest or wherever it might be really tell a big story that is hard to put into words. And another thing I think that we as producers do is we have to start having these conversations and getting outside of our comfort zone. So I was at a conference in Michigan a few years ago, a dairy conference, and they had me do a youth workshop where we taught the kids how to be professionals on Facebook and what things that they should be posting. And one of the things that I had them do was develop an elevator speech, which is who you are, where you come from, and what you do on your farm or ranch to put a nourishing food on the dinner table. Well, so I had these kids practice their elevator speeches, and then I said, okay, I'm going to play the part of the consumer in the grocery store, and you're going to come up and talk to me and ask me questions about milk or whatever. And I didn't have any volunteers, but there was this naughty 13-year-old kid in the back that I thought, I'm going to get this kid good. He was going to be my first victim. So I called him up, and he gave me his elevator speech, and he said, I'm a fifth-generation dairy farmer, and my family produces cheese, yogurt, and ice cream for your family to enjoy. And I said, wait just a minute. You mean you have cows that are farting methane into the environment and destroying the ozone layer with their gas? He looked at me, got real serious. He put a hand on his hip, and he said, you know what, Amanda? Girls fart, too. I died. I literally died. So I turned beet red, I'm like, go sit down. And I said, okay, you stumped the speaker today. I didn't have a comeback. And I said, but okay, if I had really been a consumer that day, do you think I bought a jug of milk? And if I did, do you think I felt good about it? Probably not. And I feel like so often in agriculture, we have one of two responses when someone outside of our industry asks us a question about what we do. We either laugh because we think, how naive are you to not know what a hay bale is or what a combine is or whatever it might be. Or we get defensive and we feel like we're being attacked and like our very way of life is being criticized. And neither one of those reactions are positive, they're not productive, and they don't leave a lasting impression that benefits us in the long run. And so I really think it's important to listen first. What is that consumer concerned about? In this case, that consumer wasn't concerned about the environment. And so he could have said, I hear you're concerned about the environment, and I am too, and here's what my family does to take care of the resources on our land. Another one is really one that I can relate to now that I'm a mom of two. These are my two kids that are at home in South Dakota. I'm kind of missing them, but when you become a mom, you feel guilty, right, about everything. What kind of diapers to use? Who should be my daycare provider? You know, what school should they go to? What food should I feed them? There's a lot of guilt that our consumer feels, whether they're a mom or not, when they go to the grocery store and they ask themselves, well, I hear organic or natural is better for me, but I can't afford it. So should I feel bad or guilty about feeding my kids the conventional, the generic brand option of whatever food product it might be? And even just the propaganda that these moms are being presented with online about GMOs and their formulas or their baby foods. Just a few of these if you can't read them. One says there's a 400% increase in allergies since GMOs were introduced. Or here's one, a baby has different formula brands on his belly and it says, who's making your baby a lab rat? The one up there has Roundup, a label for Roundup on the baby food, and do you know what you're feeding your children? So it's no wonder our consumers, which a lot of them are the millennial generation right now, they have the buying power in the United States. They're the ones making the decisions and developing the habits for how they're going to feed their families, you know, through the upcoming years, and they have a lot of guilt and uncertainty, and as they have as they're trying to be budget conscious, they have to even make tougher decisions, and with that comes that guilt. And so I think using resources that explain as a mom to other moms was one of the things that I focused on in recent years, why I don't feel guilty about the conventional products, or why I'm confident in the beef that I feed my kids. And so using a resource like this, if someone asks you about GMOs, which in beef production, of course, our cattle are grazing on a lot of different crops that might be genetically modified, why do we feel good about that? And I always ask myself, if someone were to walk up to me right now today, as I walk out of here in the lobby or I'm in my taxi to head back to the airport or whatever it might be, am I prepared to talk about some of those hot-button issues like transportation or hormones or whatever it might be? And if I'm not, well, then do I need to brush up on some of those things and be ready with my elevator speech so I don't miss those opportunities? Another one that goes hand in hand with guilt is that fear. And there's people that make big bucks off of fear-mongering and making our consumers feel like they can't trust their food. One of those is the Food Babe, or she's also known as the Jenny McCarthy of food. And she religiously goes after different commodities and talks about the secret, sinister ingredients that might be lurking in our foods. And guess what? She's gotten pretty rich doing just that. Here's an image of something I saw the other day. It was technology that's going to be developed that will help you scan your food so you can scan for GMOs or pesticides or whatever it might be. So just imagine the fear our consumer feels if they have to get to that point where they think they can't trust the United States food supply, the most safest and abundant and affordable supply in the world. And so one of the big ones is antibiotics. And I always tell people that I think, you know, the antibiotic discussion, it's become a bigger one in recent years as consumers are more aware of antibiotic resistance. And so, you know, whether you implement antibiotics or not in your beef production enterprise, are you prepared to talk about that? And more importantly, are you aligning yourselves with companies and groups that support the way you produce your beef product? And so in this example, I like to vote with my dollars. I really believe firmly in shopping with people that support what you do. And I don't even know, do you guys have Culver's down here? No, oh man, you need it. It's a good one. But so, like different groups like Subway, they make big stances against antibiotics, right, that we've heard. Chipotle, they're famous for serving up a side of fear with their $12 burritos. And Culver's, I guess I mentioned, they're more regional than I thought, but up in South Dakota, they're really big, burgers, ice cream, that kind of thing. But they've raised more than $1 million to support the National FFA organization. They have a campaign that says "Thank a Farmer," and they promote the farmers that raise the beef, the dairy, the lettuce, tomatoes, whatever it might be. So if I can choose somewhere to eat, I'm going to choose a place that supports what I do and wants to be a part of the conversation instead of working against me. Another great example of that is Wendy's. You guys have Wendy's down here, don't you? Okay. Good deal. Well, Wendy's spoke last year at the Cattlemen's Convention, and I listened to them, and one of the things that I really appreciated about them was that they said the best beef comes from healthy, well-cared-for animals. A sick animal needs to be treated, and you won't hear differently from us. And so when I think about the best ways that we can advocate for agriculture, you know, it always goes back to social media because that's where we can reach the most consumers. But I really think, you know, the most impactful are the ones where you meet someone in person and you develop that connection. So I always like to tell this story. I was flying home from New York City a few years ago, and I usually try to interact with as many people as I can when I'm traveling, but I was pretty tired. I was reading a book, kind of minding my own business, and a guy came and sat down next to me, and he noticed my cowboy boots I was wearing, and he said, "Are you a cowgirl?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess I am." And he said, "Well, I've never met a cowgirl before." And I, you know, he asked where I was from, and I told him that I raised cattle in South Dakota. And then I asked him what he did for a living. Well, he worked on Wall Street. And I said, "Well, I've never met a guy who works on Wall Street before." And he said, "Well, what do you want to know about us?" And I said, "Well, are you all as crooked as you sound?" And he said, "Yes, actually." So that's kind of scary. But that he was the exception to the rule. And, you know, we had a great conversation. Then I asked what he wanted to know about agriculture, and we exchanged business cards and went on our merry way. I didn't think much about it. Well, a week later, pink slime hit the news. You guys remember that? Lean, finely textured beef, and the media was reporting that it was sludge being drug up off the floor that we were feeding kids. And I get an email from my buddy on Wall Street, and he said, "What's the real deal with this pink slime thing?" And so just from one chance interaction led to a chain reaction of, okay, now this guy asked me instead of just believing what he read in the Wall Street Journal or whatever. And then when he went to happy hour with his buddies on Wall Street, well, he was going to have a credible source of information. And it just kind of, you know, balloons from there. And so I think looking for these opportunities to tell our story, you know, I think to myself, if I was sitting in the audience, I'd probably be rolling my eyes or thinking, well, you know, I got to feed the cattle, I got to fix fence, I got to do all these things on my ranch. The last thing that I want to do is get on Facebook and talk to someone that hates what I do and everything that I'm about. But I truly believe if we don't carve out that time to be advocates for our own industry, not only are we going to have a tough time making it work, but our kids and our grandkids are going to even have a tougher time yet. Because what do my kids love to watch? Disney movies. And half those Disney movies I have to throw out because the cows talk, they talk, and they stand on their back legs, and maybe the one is, he's a dude, but he has an udder, and they're not accurate, right? So, but it's that humanization of, like Meredith humanizing those pigeons instead of humanizing that homeless woman and prioritizing that. It's that not being exposed to that circle of life and understanding where our food comes from and how it gets there, and that the way we do utilize these beef animals is respectful and takes advantage of not only the nourishing beef but the byproducts too. It's that kind of conversation that our consumer hasn't had or hasn't been exposed to. And as a result, when they hear that we're harvesting cattle, well, they equate that to that dog or cat that they love and is in their Christmas picture every year, and they can't understand or bridge the gap, I guess. Confusion would be another emotion, and I pulled up a few of these things. At South Dakota State University, it's a land-grant university. It's located in the countryside. I mean, you have cows, like, literally feet from campus. And yet all three of these were presented as topic materials during my time at SDSU, and that's an agriculture school. The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan, that is actual course curriculum at Harvard University. And if you haven't heard of some of these things, they're doozies. They're Food Inc. and King Corner documentaries, but they really paint agriculture in a bad light. And so we talk about the kids watching Disney movies and being indoctrinated to think about agriculture in a certain way. Well, then our college kids who are forming habits and forming their ideals and their values and what they're going to move forward in their adult lives, well, these are the things that they're being presented with. And so there's a lot of confusion. And a good example of that is my sister's at junior in college right now. And in her freshman year, she was in, you know, one of the general English classes. And one of the assignments was to write a controversial article on your pros and cons of a topic. And so my sister went to the professor to pitch her idea. She said, "I want to write about GMOs." And the teacher was so confused that she had kind of morphed all kinds of misconceptions into one. And she told my sister, "Well, I don't want you to write on that because I'm biased about that topic. I don't let my daughter eat red meat or dairy products because I'm worried about the hormones and GMOs." It was just all kinds of different things that she had molded together so much that she had cut entire food groups out of her daughter's diet because she was worried about early onset puberty that she had read about and all sorts of different things that you hear about. And that was a college, you know, a university professor teaching an English class. And it kind of reminds me of this meme that was circulating on Facebook a while ago, but it's of a Belgian blue bull. And, of course, we know that they're double-muscled. But, you know, what do you feed a bodybuilder to your kids? The meme doesn't even make sense. But the point of it is that they were trying to say no to GMOs and everything else that would bulk up this bull. Well, we know that's just how he naturally looks. It gave my sister not only an opportunity to talk about GMOs, but to talk about hormones in food, too. So if we look at the nanograms of estrogen in an implanted versus a non-implanted steer, it's negligible, right? It's like 0.3 nanograms of estrogen and maybe 3.4 nanograms total. But, you know, in a serving of lettuce, it's in the tens of thousands. And yet it's beef is the punching bag all these years for a massive amount of hormones per serving. And so here's one I like to use on social media once in a while to try to exemplify that. So the M&Ms represent the nanograms of estrogen, and that jar is the cabbage, and then peas, potatoes, and then the half M&M or even a quarter M&M is the nanograms of estrogen in beef. So a picture can say a lot. And these instances, I think, are the most effective way to reach our consumers online. The final emotion is that romanticism. You know, just like Chipotle is famous for, you might remember their Super Bowl commercial a few years ago where Willie Nelson was singing and it was all sad and the farm was dark and dreary and the cows and the chickens were in boxes and crates and all of a sudden the sun starts shining and the birds start tweeting and the animals are frolicking free and, oh, if we could just go back to Grandpa's farm, everything would be better, right? Well, that we have, our consumers have such this romantic idea of the one cow, one chicken, one sheep operations of yesteryear that they don't necessarily equate that to, well, how much less food would we have in this country and how much more would you pay for groceries? But it really comes to play when we go back to that humanization of animals. And here's a few examples. A few years ago, you guys might remember about the Minnesota doctor that went hunting in Africa and shot this beloved lion that was like 14 years old, right? The lion was probably going to die any minute, right? Anyway, he was old. But everyone freaked out here in the United States. Oh my gosh, he killed this beloved lion that everyone saw when they would start their safaris. And they just drug this guy through the trenches. Well, the people in that African tribe didn't care about that animal, that lion, but they did care about the hundreds of thousands of dollars they lost in hunting revenue because U.S. or Americans wouldn't come and hunt anymore. But yet, it was that instead of worrying about those hungry Africans that were relying on those tourism dollars, we as Americans were crying over one silly lion. I shouldn't say that like it's not sad. If he was a beloved pet, I get it, but he wasn't. Come on, you know, it was a wild animal. Another example is this young gal from Texas that showed Oatmeal the blind steer. Do you guys remember hearing about this at all? So she got this animal to trust her, and she showed this steer that was blind, and you know, the animal rights activist got wind of it after a newspaper published, you know, her story, and they worked to save the steer from the packing plant because, you know, that was a beloved, trusted pet, and she severed that trust that we have between the 4-H kid and that market steer. And we laugh, but, you know, that's not a far cry to say, well, that steer was her pet. That's not a far jump for our consumer to think when he's on a halter or on a leash, and she broke that trust. And I was kind of disappointed in the way that one turned out because it seemed like the university and the meat plant kind of caved into some of those societal pressures, and the steer did end up going to the university where he was going to be, you know, used by the livestock judging team, and they never said, but I really hope that he was used by the meat judging team too, because that's where he was intended to go. But I wasn't kidding, I'm serious, but it just goes to show if we bow down to these activist pressures, well, by saying, okay, he doesn't need to go to the packing plant anymore, are we admitting guilt? Or maybe saying, well, you're right, maybe that steer, you know, did deserve to live another day. And then it goes back to that humanization of animals. And up in South Dakota, okay, it gets cold there, right? But there was, in Sioux Falls, the biggest city in South Dakota, it was in the news last winter, a family owned a Siberian Husky. Okay, he's Alaska. You know, they can handle the cold. Well, they had this Siberian Husky out in the yard during a blizzard. I mean, maybe he should have been inside. I don't know. But he was probably used to being outside. It was probably fine. Well, the neighbors called and reported this guy, and he got arrested in front of his kids for something common sense like having a Siberian Husky outside. And so then it started the conversation, what constitutes animal abuse and who defines it? And if it's not you and I, well, is castration, is dehorning, is working a cattle through a chute animal abuse, is putting them on a trailer to transport them from a cow-calf operation to a feed yard, is that abuse? If we're not part of the conversation, someone else is going to do those definitions for us, and it could be pretty scary what they come up with. And so I always like to share this, another graphic I like to share. This is the beef byproduct story. And, you know, the people that think they're vegans or vegetarians for moral, ethical reasons, well, I like to point out all the many ways that they use beef, even if they're not eating cheeseburgers. So how can we find common ground with our consumers? I think, you know, we talked about the emotions that our consumers feel when they go to the grocery store. Well, how can we use our emotions to tell our story and kind of appeal? And so I think it goes back to family values, the fact that we heard from Family Farm, that they've been doing this for generations with their kids, you know, and it's something they do as a family. Animal welfare, taking care of the environment. What do we do to be stewards of the land and to take care of those animals? Is our food safe? Does it taste good? What are the nutritional aspects? How does that beef benefit a person in wanting to eat a healthier diet? We know our stories better than anyone else, but it's just a matter of getting out there and appealing to our customers. And know your audience. I just recently read a blog post by Cammie Ryan, who works for Monsanto, and she kind of broke it down to ways that we can be more effective communicators online. The first she said was be clever and be creative. You know, you got to entertain first, inform second. So we all have this mission that we want to talk about hormones or antibiotics or cattle feed or whatever it might be. So we have all the research and science, but how do we make it entertaining? In a society today where we're constantly looking at things on our phones and we're looking for the next, you know, clickbait or whatever interesting article it might be, how do we engage that consumer and get them to look at what we have to say? Stories not only have to be compelling, but they must be useful to the audience. They need to be accessible, so go where the people are. You know, you and I can talk all day about being agriculture advocates, but unless we put it into practice, it's pretty useless. So go step outside of your comfort zone and have those conversations. They have to be relatable. You know, we can talk heifers and AI and whatever all day long, but if our consumer doesn't know the difference between a boy cow and a girl cow, well, then we might have lost them at the first word heifer. So understand who your audience is and make it relatable to them. And transferable. Understand the belief systems of our consumers, people like Meredith, who live in New Jersey, who have never met a rancher before, and try to bridge that gap and get their attention in ways that they value or things that they value. I'm generally a pretty positive person, you know, even when the cattle markets are tough and we're doing our best at home to keep pushing our goals forward, I always try to turn positive or turn something negative into a positive. So I think being out there and doing positive beef promotions can only benefit what we do at home. And so the CheckF has like Team Beef that you can be a part of, and you can promote beef as a protein to athletes, because they're spending mega bucks on protein shakes and protein bars, and why can't we get them just eating beef again and make that cool again? I talked about reaching out to moms, and because I'm a mom, I can add credibility to a conversation on online mom groups where moms are asking about, you know, I need to get some more protein in my kids' diet, and they don't like to eat anything. Do you have ideas? And sharing recipes or whatever it might be. And then another thing I'm really proud to be a part of is the All-American Beef Battalion. Have you guys, anybody heard of that at all? A few of you? Well, if you haven't, I was started by Vietnam veteran Bill Brody. In 2007, when I was out in Washington, D.C., I got a phone call from a buddy of mine, Trent Luce out of Nebraska, and he said, I got this Vietnam vet. He wants to start this organization. We need you to get our application for nonprofit status to the Secretary of Ag. So me, the little intern, walked down the hall and gave him the application, and that was my big part in getting the Beef Battalion off the ground. But since then, I guess Bill Brody, his main motivation was he came home from Vietnam. He had lost a leg. He, of course, was met with protests and people that didn't appreciate him and his fellow soldiers' sacrifice, and he didn't want today's men and women serving our country to feel underappreciated. And so the All-American Beef Battalion was formed as a way for a cowboy from Kansas to say thank you to the men and women serving our country. And so since 2007, they've served close to 350,000 ribeyes at steak feeds across the country. So if you know of a group that's deploying or coming home, they'll come, they'll put on the ribeye steak dinner, and you can bet those military men and women and their families have a positive impression about who we are in agriculture and what we're all about. And if you also want to support them, I guess the link is right there in blue if you can't see it, but steaksfortroops.com. Here's another example of turning something negative into a positive. A few years ago at Christmas time, I don't know if you guys remember this, but the vegan crowd was really up in arms about this Walmart semi-truck toy, the slaughterhouse truck, they called it. And, you know, they were boycotting Walmart and making a big fuss about it. Well, what did cowboys do instead? Well, they started buying these slaughterhouse trucks in bulk and giving them away to kids in need. So they changed the rhetoric. They did something good and did something positive in the world. And they didn't let the PETAs of the world, drown out the true message, was that in agriculture, we do have hearts of gold. We believe in our product. We believe in what we do. And we're not going to put more negative out there in the world. We're going to focus on doing the positive. And I think, honestly, 98% of our consumer, for as loud as that 2% of the vegan crowd are, 98% of our consumers just want to know that they can trust the food that they're putting on the dinner plate. And so it does go back to that emotions. A few last things. I guess in 2011, I wrote a children's book called Levi's Lost Calf. It tells the story of ranch life on a South Dakota ranch and during fall roundup. And, you know, the cow does not talk in my book. The rancher does the talking. And so a calf gets misplaced, and then the ranch kid has to go around the ranch and try to find that calf. And the reader gets introduced to the wildlife and the different things that you might find on a cattle operation. And my goal with writing a book it's not a get-rich-quick scheme by any means, but when I was speaking across the country, I wanted to be able to get into elementary schools, too, and try to change the rhetoric from what these kids have been introduced to. And so I've been all over the country, and I always have to laugh. I always allow questions at the end. And I was in California a few years ago, and the first kid lines up and asks this question. He says, "So, Amanda, how does the baby calf get into the mama cow?" Well, I'm not going to explain the birds and the bees today, kid. That's when I went and asked, "Well, do you guys know what a boy cow and a girl cow is called?" And they didn't. So we talked about heifers and bulls, and I thought, go ask your mom the rest, you know. And then the next kid asks, you know, how does the baby cow get out of the mama cow? And again, I wasn't going to draw a diagram, but I talked about things that they could relate to, like, well, you know, our moms carry babies for 9 months, and cows are pretty similar, and that rancher acts like the doctor and gets that calf off to a good start. And so hopefully by meeting them on their level, they'll think about some of those things when they met that cool, you know, author rancher from South Dakota, instead of maybe the things that they're being, that's being pushed on the Disney Channel. And I guess I should say I do have these for sale for $10 a piece after, if you're interested. So here's just a quick study from the Center for Food Integrity Survey. You know, it can feel pretty daunting when we look online today. You could probably find 10 negative things that are being said about agriculture right now. And how do you even begin to start counteracting some of that negativity? In fact, I should tell this story. A few years ago in the New York Times, there was an article about a couple that had a pet hamster that they had stomped on, and they were arrested for animal abuse. Well, the author, or the writer of this article, told that story and said, well, if they should be charged with animal abuse, so should the nation's livestock producers who kill hundreds of thousands of animals each year. And then he went and compared you and me to Nazis and the Holocaust, and it was the same as that. And I went and looked through. There were 16,000 comments on this article, like a massive amount of comments. Comments period was closed. I went and scrolled through those comments, and there wasn't a single positive one from the animal agriculture crowd. It was a lot of vegans, of course, and it was a lot of people saying, I'm so glad I read this. I've never thought about it before. I'm never going to eat meat again. So we truly cannot afford to lose these opportunities or bypass these opportunities to tell our story or at least balance out the conversation. But this study shows that kind of the tone of what our consumers are thinking about, so it might be a little fine print here, but 55% say the food system is headed in the right track, up from 34%. 40% believe they have ample information about where their food comes from, up from 17% the year before. Half say they are confident in the food they eat, up from 35%. 59% trust the food produced here and abroad, up from 51%, and 44% believe the U.S. food is the most affordable in the world, up from 30%. So generally, our consumer is maybe headed in the right track, but I don't want to lose ground. And so I hope if you take home one thing from my presentation is that you feel more empowered to go out there and engage. You feel like it is an important part of your business plan or your business model, and make a reachable goals, attainable goals. So whether that be retweet or share a blog post that I've written on Beef Magazine, or start a blog post of your own, or a blog of your own, or use some of the checkoff funded resources and images that are available and just share those, just to stay active and involved. And if you make that a habit, it quickly becomes second nature, and I do think we can make a difference slowly but surely. So with that, I guess, how are we doing on time? I kind of whipped through the last part there. I guess with that, I can entertain any questions if there are any.